The relationship between religion, imperialism, and national identity can be quite complex. At the same time, nationalist readings of history, particularly when they are combined with other ideological perspectives, can easily provide reductionist narratives that do not do full justice to these complicated realities. The history of Catholicism in Vietnam is a case in point, as nationalist and communist histories tend to present the Catholic Church as the friend of French colonialism, with Catholic apologists defending their church's role in Vietnamese history in accordance with nationalist standards. In his book, Catholic Vietnam, A Church from Empire to Nation, published by University of California Press, Berkeley in 2012, Dr. Charles Keith challenges such overly simple narratives by tracing the transformation in the Catholic Church in Vietnam from the pre-colonial through the colonial to the post-liberation periods, ending in approximately 1954. For instance, through his careful, rich, and detailed study, Keith shows how Vietnamese Catholics could remain Catholic while being at times pro-colonial, anti-colonial, pro-left, anti-communists, and other places within and without these labels as their community transformed from a colonial to a national church. Thus, Keith's study is well worth a read for anyone interested in Vietnamese history or the history of Christianity. I hope you'll enjoy the interview. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies. I'm Dr. Franklin Rausch of Lander University, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Charles Keith about his new book, Catholic Vietnam, A Church from Empire to Nation. Charles, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. So as traditional here, I'd like just to begin by asking you to tell us a little about yourself, where you were born, where you went to school, anything you feel comfortable talking about.
Sure. Well, I was actually born in France. My mother's French, and I grew up in the States, but grew up with the language, with French, and with an interest in France, a lot of trips back there. So, I think that's where my origin, those are the origins of my interest in French colonial history. I went to Cornell as an undergraduate, which is one of the hotbeds of Southeast Asian studies. Kind of ironically, I had nothing to do with that when I was there. So it's a bit of a fake pedigree. And in between school and graduate school, I actually took a trip to Southeast Asia, which kind of kindled my interest in the region. And so I focused on it in graduate school at Yale.
Oh, excellent. And so what was it that attracted to Vietnam particularly?
Well, I think this first a general interest in the French colonial empire, which I did spend some time studying in college. Obviously, as an American interested in history and, one who kind of grew up, came of age in the 80s in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, I as I grew up, I came to have a pretty strong curiosity about, about the country that stemmed, I think, in large part, obviously, from the war. My trip over there, that was kind of the main purpose of the trip, even though I went to a bunch of different countries. The place I really wanted to see was Vietnam. When I got there, I spent about a month there. I just really liked the place. I felt comfortable there. It was a place that I really felt like I wanted to learn more about. So, beyond this kind of initial interest in the war, which, frankly, I teach a lot about the war, but, my interest in it has obviously broadened quite a bit beyond that. In those years. And that trip was in 2000. So it's been, I've been going there, pretty regularly for 15 years now. So, and I still really like the place. I really love going there. I don't get to go as often as I'd like. But, and I think obviously that's important with a research site. So, still happy to be going back there when I get the chance.
Oh, excellent. And I just want to put, so, and for your, this book, you've used in English, French, and Vietnamese sources.
That's right.
Right. So that's really amazing. I mean, it's oftentimes, someone will only use one language. It's great if you can get in two languages, but you've gotten in three.
Yeah. Well, I had the benefit of speaking French as a child, so I never had to study French to really master it. And I guess unlike some native speakers, I did learn to read. I read as a kid. So my French was really at a pretty fluent level when I started graduate school. So that allowed me to spend some time, well, really a lot of time on Vietnamese, which I started when I started graduate school. Actually spent, I think, kind of the big transition point to research capability was a year I spent in Vietnam in 04, 05 on a language study fellowship, thanks to the Blake Moore Freeman Foundation. That really kind of put me, I'd been studying for about 3 years at that point, and that really put me over the edge to where I was really comfortable, researching in the language and living there.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. So we've got then the French part, we've got the Vietnam part. How then do you write a book about Catholic Vietnam?
It's a good question. My background is, not really in religious history. And maybe we'll talk about this at the end. And I'm not really working on religious history now. My interest in the subject really stemmed from the very kind of the fascinating and complicated and poorly understood role of the Catholic community in modern Vietnamese history, which, as we'll get into during the questions, is highly politicized and kind of poorly understood. So in many ways, my interest in the Catholic community in Vietnam really stemmed from the fact that I really felt that exploring their history in a kind of more complex and nuanced way would be a way to kind of complicate Vietnamese history more broadly. And, in many ways, I think the sort of two-dimensional role of Catholics in Vietnamese history parallels a lot of other poorly understood dimensions of Vietnamese history, whether religious or otherwise. So I think it was, a general sense that studying this subject could really, would really bring a lot of benefit, I think, to the field of Vietnamese history more broadly. So I didn't come at the subject from a sort of a deep pre-existing interest in religious history. And, arguably, again, we'll probably get at this in the questions, but I think, real scholars of religion reading this book might actually think, well, there's not actually a whole lot of religion in there. There's not a lot of belief. There's not a lot of theology. And I totally take that point. I mean, I think the book is really more kind of cultural and political history of a religious community rather than religious history as some people might think of it.
Right. Well, that brings us then to the introduction of your book. You talked about how there were some problems in how Catholicism is viewed in the history of Vietnam. Could you give us some examples then of how Catholics are treated in the histories of Vietnam and how you would help to build upon them?
Sure. Well, my sense of this is that a lot of the kind of the place of Catholicism in modern Vietnamese history and historiography stems from the community's, sort of general opposition to communism, which was, of course, the most important dimension of the Vietnamese revolution. Catholic anti-communism gave rise to, especially during and especially after the war, at least a Vietnamese language historiography, which parallels a sort of broader idea of Catholicism as, because it was anti-communism, therefore it was kind of anti-national in some way, and in the most extreme forms, kind of anti-Vietnamese, right? So it rests on this sort of very political idea that communism is sort of the sole legitimate vehicle for Vietnamese nationalist aspirations, and that Catholics, because of their opposition by and large to that, were opposed much more fundamentally to the idea of Vietnamese independence. I think that's frankly nonsense, and obviously a very politicized way of thinking about the history of Catholicism in Vietnam. So I think that's the kind of the main origin for this idea. And then, a lot of Western language work on Vietnam was heavily influenced by these kind of nationalist ideas and idioms during the war. So a lot of Western scholars generally kind of tended to accept, a sort of softer viewpoint of this as a Catholics, having very strong kind of international European connections and, Catholicism being something that, had a kind of a fraught relationship with Vietnamese culture and Vietnamese society, even if, some of the scholarship didn't take quite so kind of dogmatic a viewpoint as the communist nationalist historiography in Vietnam did.
Right. And so, okay, excellent. So, yeah, and that's one thing I thought was really fascinating about your book was this attempt to engage with this kind of historiography and give us this more nuanced understanding of how this all works. And that's something I think about my own work and in the relationship between Korean nationalism and Catholicism. Mm-hmm. So you open then your book with the story of these three Vietnamese Catholic priests. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could tell us briefly, recap that story and tell us why that story is so important for understanding this more nuanced view of.
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating story. And, you know, in brief, it involves the story of three Vietnamese priests who became involved with a kind of an early anti-colonial movement in the early part of the 20th century. And they followed this famous anti-colonial figure who was not Catholic at all and who has since become a kind of a, you know, Vietnamese national hero. So, you know, I found it fascinating that, first of all, that these priests were involved with this movement. And I should say that the story itself is relatively well known, although poorly understood. And I sort of started with it because it seemed to symbolize a lot of what I just talked about as far as the historiography goes. And you see these priests come up in Vietnamese language historiography, and they're generally put forward as an example of quote-unquote good Catholics. You know, Catholics who understood the need for national liberation and were willing to participate in these national liberation movements, anti-colonial movements. But for me, what was interesting about this is that their reasons for becoming involved in this movement were totally, I say, unknown and poorly understood. And what I discovered when I dug into the episode, in a sense, mirrors a lot of the work that I did in the book, is that their reasons for being anti-colonial stemmed really from profound and disruptive changes in Catholic life itself, specifically some very, very real tensions between the Vietnamese clergy, and European missionaries, and the really changing relationship between European Catholics and Vietnamese Catholics at this time. Really, kind of profound changes in Catholic institutional life. So some of these changes that are really at the heart of the book's kind of early chapters. So this dimension of it, I think is kind of poorly understood. Vietnamese tend to think, well, you know, these priests, of course they were anti-national or sort of anti-colonial. The good Catholics were, and then the bad Catholics were not, right? And I think, thinking of it in that way sort of misses the point, right? To really understand why these priests did what they did and acted the way they did, you have to kind of get into the history of the community much more deeply than people have to this point.
Right. It's interesting. I don't know enough about it, but this reminds me of one of the incident of in the Philippines in the 19th century, where you had these three nationalist priests who get executed.
Right.
It's much more complex than
right.
than it first seems.
Sure. Well, you know, that actually brings up a book that that I admire a lot is Ilato's book, Passion and Revolution, right? And this sort of tells this story of, essentially how Christian idioms and stories and traditions could be, you know, very compatible with a kind of nationalist anti-colonial sentiment, right? He did this in a kind of very deep, almost anthropological way that I really admire and that I felt was deeply lacking in the Vietnamese historiography. Now, I didn't approach the subject at all in the same way that he did, but I think the sort of the spirit of the two books are similar.
Right. So you begin then, you've set up things very well in the introduction, showing how this is going to be a very complex story. And you begin looking at the Catholic Church during a kind of time of transition before the French have come to power in Vietnam. So could you tell us a little bit about what was that church like before the French come to power?
Sure. Well, it's hard to answer quickly because it has a very long history. But I guess what I would say is this, from the origins of the sort of the arrival of the religion to Vietnam in the late 16th century until the early 19th century, you know, you have like anywhere else in Asia, episodes of conflict between kind of political authority and the religion. But by and large, the history of those 200 or so years are really a history of, you know, conflict and tension is much more isolated than people imagine. You know, and the religion becomes a kind of a small but kind of well-integrated part of society, especially in northern Vietnam. Now, things start to really change in the early 19th century because of basically a sort of revitalized, modernizing imperial project in Vietnam. This is when the territory of Vietnam is basically unified. It's kind of two warring kingdoms. There's a war and the territory is unified, and the victorious ruling house essentially embarks on a state building project that has some very strong ideological Confucian components. So the church at the time is seen as a kind of a threat to this in a way that other Vietnamese dynasties didn't really necessarily view it, right? So by mid-century, you add the French dimension, and the French are kind of increasing their influence in the region. And this is basically this mixture produces, I think, what one historian described as an intractable conflict, right? Where essentially growing French intervention in the region gets this dynasty increasingly kind of concerned with Catholicism and repressive of Catholicism. Anti-Catholic edicts and actions result in, you know, the Catholic community becoming, you know, even more sort of politically opposed to the rule of this Vietnamese dynasty and connected to the growing French influence. So when the French finally intervene, a lot of Catholics fight on the side of the French. So this is often seen in the historiography that I've discussed as a kind of evidence of a pro-colonial mindset among Vietnamese Catholics. And, you know, I think it's important to think of it more as a sort of kind of logical political decision, you know, in a period of time when the Vietnamese dynasty was in power, the Nguyen dynasty was being highly repressive of the Catholic community. Lots of other groups in Vietnamese society at the time, I think, had the same fraught relationship with the Nguyen dynasty and made the same decision to kind of fight alongside the French against the Nguyen dynasty. But it was a sort of fateful decision for Catholics because it definitely, you know, in large part because of their religion, sort of tarred them with the epithet of kind of pro-colonial. And I think, you know, very quickly, as we'll discuss in a minute, you know, the relationship of Catholics to the colonial project became, you know, very complicated and I think just as fraught as any other community in Vietnam. So Catholics didn't enjoy any sort of special privilege under French colonial rule, and they weren't really their views on colonialism didn't really differ that markedly from any other community in Vietnam.
Right. And it sounds, and I think that's fascinating because it sounds kind of counterintuitive that a, you know, Catholic power comes into Vietnam in the form of France, and that doesn't help them
right
in many ways. So what kind of transformations are going on then when the French come to power?
Well, you know, another book that really influenced this one. In fact, when I started graduate school, it was really kind of the book that I wanted to write, but somebody beat me to it. It's a book called An Empire Divided by James P. Dotton at Stanford. It's a much more kind of French colonial approach to church-state relations and to the role of the church in the empire. But, you know, his major insight was the French Empire expanded in the late 19th century precisely at the moment when French politics was becoming really anti-clerical, really beginning in the 1880s, really through, you know, until World War II, most French regimes had a complicated and fraught relationship with the Catholic Church. This is a time of, you know, similar kind of nation-building enterprise in France that seeks to really exclude the church from many of the kind of positions of influence that it had in public life to that point in France, right? So, you know, France is obviously, you know, a Catholic power in some sense, but in important senses, it really was not. It was actually in some ways a kind of anti-Catholic power. So the relationship between French missionaries and the French colonial state is very complicated and often really very bad at the very beginning of French rule in Vietnam. And this is a kind of a reality to colonial politics that I think lots of scholars of colonialism have just missed completely. And they just assume that, you know, France was generally supportive of the missionary enterprise in its empire, when in reality it was not. Right. So this is a big part of the story.
Right. And just as an aside, that the book you mentioned by Dott, and I use that a lot in my own work. It's a very good book.
Great book. Yeah, it's a great book.
So that then brings us to your second chapter, A Colonial Church Divided, because it's not this kind of simple relationship here. So I wonder, could you tell us about what conflicts then exist within the Catholic Church in Vietnam and what causes them?
All right, so the first one, I guess, builds on the last point, which is the conflict between missionaries and the French colonial state. Much like in France, you know, there's a well-established missionary presence in Vietnam at this time that's, in fact, growing quite quickly. And much like in France, the French colonial state initially tries to kind of counteract the influence of these missionaries, you know, doing things like excluding them from colonial hospitals. And, you know, essentially the French educational school system is kind of a parallel kind of competing system to the Catholic school system. I mean, it's much bigger, but the French administrators view the relationship with missionaries much like French Republican officials in France view their relationship with the church. And it's one that's often kind of antagonistic. Now, there is a kind of a modus vivendi that established that emerges. You know, it's not entirely hostile all the time, right? But the reality is much closer to what's going on in France than it is to this image of, you know, missionaries and French colonial authorities as kind of marching hand in hand, waving the flag and kind of unproblematically both supporting the kind of the same enterprise. They weren't on the same team. So that's conflict number one. I think the bigger conflict that's really at the heart of this book is the growing conflict between Vietnamese Catholics and French Catholics. I mentioned a minute ago that this is a time of enormous missionary expansion. For the French conquest of Vietnam allows for a much larger number of missionaries to come into Vietnam. They have much greater freedom of movement. You know, I mean, they can go and they can proselytize. There's a big kind of flow of money. This is seen as a, you know, a really rich opportunity for the growth of, you know, this particular mission field. So statistically, I mean, I think the number of missionaries goes up from something like 50 in mid-century to, I don't have the book in front of me, but hundreds and hundreds of missionaries, 400 or 500 French missionaries and a couple hundred Spanish missionaries. So, you know, from 50 to say 700 in less than two generations. And what this means for the Catholic community is it's really significant. You have many more missionaries. They're in control of bigger budgets, so they have greater institutional control over things like seminaries and schools, public health institutions, right, social welfare institutions. They're also they have a much more greater influence over religious life, right? So their conceptions of religious life, what's okay to do, what's not to do, what's orthodox, what's not. You know, this has a much greater presence in, you know, especially rural Catholic communities than ever before. So the conflicts you see, you know, are especially pronounced between Vietnamese priests and French missionaries, because what missionaries are essentially doing is displacing Vietnamese priests from many of their, you know, traditional positions of authority and influence, either whether over institutions or over believers, right? So this is a huge source of conflict. And then, of course, some of the broader conflicts of colonial rule come into play as well. The fact that Vietnamese Catholics are now ruled over by the French, you know, often very harshly, leads them to view missionaries, whether fairly or not, as somehow connected to this enterprise, right? So this is all kind of mixing together to produce some really strong, I guess, kind of racial tensions within the church around the turn of the 20th century.
Right. So it's this, it's to me, it was amazing. And they, I mean, part of this conflict, right, the number of conversions stagnated, like, even though you're getting all these missionaries, right, it doesn't seem to be helping.
That's right. I think this is not, you know, this is not the only example of that, you know, in the history of the Catholic Church. But yeah, that's exactly right. It doesn't really, you know, the huge expansion, institutional mission expansion, doesn't really produce conversions. I think a lot of this is due to the kind of the complicated and tension producing nature of that expansion in general. A lot of it has to do with the much more complex and kind of tense role of the Catholic community in Vietnamese society after the colonial conquest, right? Which absolutely, you know, it saw the Catholics, you know, kind of closely linked to the French Navy and the French military during the wars of conquest. And, you know, without a doubt, a lot of Vietnamese viewed the church as kind of connected to the French conquest in a really deep way, in a way that I think overstated the reality, both of the influence of Catholics in facilitating the conflict or the conquest. You know, I would say that Catholics had, you know, very little influence on the outcome, right? But also the reasons for Catholic, let's say, connections to France during the wars of conquest. But, you know, absolutely all these things, I think, produce, really, in a sense, I don't have enough data to really kind of say this conclusively demographically, but I'd say this tentatively is a period where, you know, conversion as a kind of a mass process kind of stops and the community becomes essentially kind of self-replicating.
So that then brings us to chapter three, the birth of a national church. The Vatican sees this kind of conflict and it has some concerns. Could you tell us, how does the Vatican then help make this into a national church and why?
So and maybe this wouldn't have been as big a surprise to someone who had a better training in the history, the modern history of the Catholic Church globally. But for me, one of the big surprises of this story was the Vatican and their role in this process. So I guess to sort of briefly, right after World War I, the Vatican kind of puts into motion a process to, it's what I would describe as nationalized, right? To build national churches that, you know, to ultimately make them independent from missionary authority. And there are a lot of reasons for this. One of them is the really important one is the First World War, right? This is something that I think was the culmination about 30, 40 years of really growing tensions between the Vatican and national states in Europe. It was also, I think, a moment when people at the Vatican started to, you know, try to imagine the kind of the future of the church in the 20th century. And I think they really believed that, kind of a missionary model in Asia and in Africa would not be forever sustainable, and that much more significant and serious efforts had to be made to essentially place churches in those places in the hands of Asians and Africans, right? A lot of this had to do with also, I think, stemmed from a real concern, I would even say a sort of a moral concern that people at the Vatican had with the kind of outlook and behavior of some missionaries, right, who had, despite their tensions with colonial states, had largely accepted a lot of the sort of racial ideas of the time, right? These were people who, they were missionaries, but they also believed in kind of biological racial differences, and a lot of those beliefs kind of seeped into or informed, their relationships with, in this case, Vietnamese Catholics. So, you know, there's a real post-war kind of rejection of these ideas in a very explicit way coming out of the Vatican. And, you know, for me, that was really kind of surprising. My understanding, you know, later in the interwar period, especially around World War II, you know, I'm familiar with the Vatican's anti-communism and, you know, their kind of opposition to national liberation movements of a leftist character, especially. But, you know, at the beginning of the interwar period, the Vatican is a very kind of, you know, almost kind of progressive force, really, really pushing in a very meaningful way for the development of indigenous churches in a way that was often really resisted by missionaries.
Right. Yeah. So you were saying that the missionaries are reacting or resisting this. The French colonial officials are resisting. So why are MEP missionaries, you know, reacting to this negatively? Why would they oppose this?
Well, it's a good question. And, you know, not all of them did. Certainly some of them saw this as, you know, a natural and welcome evolution. But, you know, you have to appreciate the sort of the enormous cultural and institutional changes that this brought, right? A lot of them really worried, you know, I would say with good intentions, they worried that the church wouldn't be able to survive this kind of transition. They really believed that, you know, only Europeans had the kind of expertise and experience that was necessary for the church to, you know, survive and to continue to grow in Vietnam. So, you know, a lot of this resistance reflected really kind of deep-seated cultural attitudes that really just assumed that for the church to really continue to exist, there had to be kind of missionary oversight, right? So the colonial state was opposed to this for, you know, some very different reasons. One of the kind of aha, eureka documents very early in the research process was a document I found in the French Foreign Ministry archives in Paris. And it was about the opposition of the French Foreign Ministry to the impending ordination of the first Vietnamese bishop in 1933. And, you know, French foreign policy officials were, you know, really kind of worrying about this and opposed to the change and worried about the symbolic implications of it. And, you know, when I saw this, this was at the very beginning of my research, I thought, now why in the world would they be opposed to something like this? You know, this would seem to be, you know, in some sense, a kind of validation of their civilizing mission, right? A sort of a colonial subject rising so high in the hierarchy of the church. But, you know, when I dug into this, and this was the first scholarly article I wrote on this project was about the first Vietnamese bishops, is that this change seemed, what it did was it sort of paralleled independence, right? It seemed to prove that Vietnamese were perfectly capable of heading, in this case, the church. You know, if they were capable of doing that, why wouldn't they be capable of running their own country, right? So it had, I would say, ominous and even negative political implications in the eyes of French colonial authorities. And, I found that really fascinating. And when I read more into it, I, you know, realized just what an unbelievably important event this was for Vietnamese Catholics, precisely because of the political and cultural implications that it had, right? It wasn't only about a bishop, a Vietnamese priest becoming a bishop. It really symbolized something broader, right? About the kind of the sort of atmosphere of anti-colonialism, cultural modernization, and, you know, a kind of desire for independence from France. So this change was something that, and I can talk a lot about this, but it was something that allowed Vietnamese to relate to these kind of broader cultural forces, precisely because there were such strong parallels between the rise of a national church and the desire for an independent nation, which were so powerful in the late colonial era.
Well, yeah, a lot of these bishops you're looking at, they are not pro-French.
No, they're not. They're very much, they're not pro-French, right? I mean, they're obviously, you know, deeply connected to France in a sense that it's such an important part of their kind of education. France is such a kind of critical part of the Catholic world, but, you know, they're not at all pro-colonial, right? A lot of them really believe that, you know, empire is something that, you know, that should end, right, ultimately. And, you know, they're not revolutionaries by any means. You know, they're not, and, you know, this comes out later in the story. But, you know, that doesn't make them pro-colonial in any meaningful sense.
Well, I thought it was fascinating that you pointed out that they are, at times, they see the French colonial state as the enemy of the faith.
That's right. That's right. And they had, you know, they had some real kind of material and empirical reasons for thinking this. You know, again, the history of this period does see some, you know, some pretty regular and serious opposition on the part of French administrators to the expansion of Catholic missions. So, you know, they have perfectly real reasons for religious reasons for opposing colonialism. Right. And then, of course, another really important reason that that they're critical of colonialism is the opposition of the colonial state to the development of a national church, which was really, I think, as far as the, you know, the bishops go, you know, something that they obviously believed in, you know, maybe more than anything. And they this is something that they really committed their lives to. Right. To building a Vietnamese church.
And an important aspect of building a Vietnamese church was print media, which you give a whole chapter to.
That's right.
So I wonder then if you could tell us, what role did print media play traditionally in Vietnamese Catholic life, and what new developments marked the colonial period?
So, you know, like most of Vietnamese society, in the pre-colonial period, literacy was relatively limited, and it was closely tied to, you know, kind of East Asian tradition, kind of traditional education, in characters, mostly, you know, people who were educated typically were, you know, from a fairly elite slice of society. You know, most Catholic, Vietnamese Catholic priests in the pre-colonial period were literate, but very few of the laity were. I mean, I couldn't give a number. But so the colonial period is sees the rise of, in Vietnam, it's a really important transition, the emergence of a Romanized script to write Vietnamese. And this actually has Catholic origins. It emerged first as a, basically as a system to teach missionaries how to pronounce the Vietnamese vernacular. So it's written with a Romanized alphabet. And it's a lot easier for, obviously, for Europeans to learn. And it kind of evolved as a Vietnamese Catholic written system in the 17th and 18th centuries, 19th century. In the colonial period, the French colonial state ultimately start to kind of cultivate this and support it and to build it into their administration and educational system. And Vietnamese modernizing intellectuals, too, start to kind of grab onto this. It's kind of a long and complicated history of that script. But, you know, the outcome is for Catholics and, like, for everybody else, the rise of Romanization, new printing technology leads to a rise in literacy. You know, and I view print media, like a lot of other people, I'm really heavily influenced by Benedict Anderson's Imagined Communities and the importance of print media and print capitalism and literacy on politics and modern identity. So that chapter really is kind of, you know, sort of rooted on that idea, right? And I guess one of the big takeaways of the chapter is that print media plays a really important part, a role in kind of connecting Vietnamese Catholics, right? The importance of a newspaper as a kind of, you know, national space, right? In this case, a national religious space in which, you know, Catholics from different parts of the country with no previous contact to one another are kind of, you know, reading the same stuff and kind of participating in a sense in the same community. So that's, I think, one of the big kind of points of that chapter.
What kind of, you know, what sort of things are they reading that can either support, you know, their faith or colonial rule, or that challenge those things?
Well, so this is so the rise of a Vietnamese Catholic print sphere is happening precisely during kind of the Vatican's push to nationalize the Vietnamese church, so really the 1920s and 1930s. And the two processes are really inextricably linked. In fact, the Vatican pushes for, you know, the expansion of a Vietnamese Catholic newspaper sphere, right? So Catholic newspapers written in Vietnamese for a Vietnamese audience. So not surprisingly, a lot of the content in these newspapers is kind of focuses on that. It focuses on kind of international Catholic issues and questions. You know, it's translating a lot of stuff from the Vatican. into Vietnamese, whether it's, you know, encyclicals on, you know, trying to, on the promotion and development of a national church, or, you know, other kind of Vatican statements, written work, in European languages translated into Vietnamese on these issues. So, it's a very kind of cosmopolitan, kind of almost kind of global print sphere, in the Vietnamese language that, that arises at this time. So, it really gives Vietnamese Catholic access to, I mean, it's really the principal vehicle for how they come to, you know, learn about and understand, these changes, global changes in Catholic life, and to kind of debate them and even participate in them, right? It's also a way for Vietnamese Catholics to begin to write themselves about things going on, you know, in their church. Now, obviously they were doing this before, but these kind of Vietnamese Catholic writings about Vietnamese Catholic issues are now spread much more broadly to a much more, literate audience, right? So it is, a kind of really, really crucial, vehicle in the development of a kind of a broader national religious consciousness, if I could put it that way.
Well, that makes perfect sense. And I really got a lot out of this chapter because it was making me think about what was going on in Korea at a similar time, because the Catholics there were really trying, but they were in a much weaker position, mm-hmm. Than the Vietnamese. But this was especially fascinating, was how, especially how skilled at French,
right.
These Catholics became, because you didn't so much have that in Korea, which made it difficult for them to take part in these broader discussions. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so some of them were absolutely quite quite skilled in French, and a lot of this is also happening, really, I would say, principally in Vietnamese. It is really a fascinating evolution.
So that acts as kind of a segue, kind of talking about, now we have a national church born. We talk about, you know, then this is chapter, how print is transforming and shaping that church. Mm-hmm. And in chapter 5, you have you discuss what's called a national church experience.
Right.
So I guess kind of my question, I mean, this is still a church under colonial rule.
Right.
So what do you mean by national church?
So I guess what I mean is culturally national, right? So obviously the country is still under colonial rule. Institutionally, the Vietnamese Catholic Church is not yet independent from missionary authority. That doesn't happen until the post-colonial period. But I guess my argument in this chapter is that, as is often the case in colonial contexts, a kind of a cultural nationalism, or a kind of sense of a cultural sense or a cultural experience of nationalism precedes actually, independence, right? Sort of formal nationalism, if you will, right? So what I mean by a national church, I'm kind of developing that in the earlier chapter. So you get the sort of the institutional seeds of this process through the bishops. You get the kind of cultural vehicles of this process in print. And then in chapter 5, I look more closely at, essentially lay Catholic experiences that I would argue contributed to a sort of a nationwide Catholic identity, right? So the idea that, you're a Catholic in this place, but you're not only a Catholic from a particular region or a particular diocese, but a really strong sense of kind of even almost kind of ethnic, racial nationalism, and its overlaps with the religious community, if you see, right? So the idea of kind of being Vietnamese and Catholic. Right, so what are some of these vehicles? Things like, I think there's the associational networks, which really expand in the colonial period. So kind of Vietnamese Catholic associations that exist across Vietnam, across the three different parts of Vietnamese parts of French Indochina. I write about pilgrimage in this chapter. There's a really important Vietnamese Catholic pilgrimage located basically roughly in the center of the country. It's surrounding a Marian apparition in 1798. But it's really for the first time that this pilgrimage becomes a kind of a national process, right? So Catholics from all over Vietnam are making this pilgrimage to this you know, unfamiliar place. They're meeting Catholics from across the country. You know, they're participating in these kind of nationwide kind of events and festivals. They're reading about this in newspapers. So it's a kind of it's something that becomes a kind of national cultural event at this time. There are also international Catholic festivals that start to happen in Vietnam at this time. So kind of, you know, international festivals of the Eucharist and that sort of thing. So this is a, you know, kind of basically the argument is that awareness of these things, participation in these events cultivates a kind of a national consciousness in a way that didn't really exist before. I think the other thing that I discuss in that chapter is migration. There is a lot more migration in the colonial period than before. People are moving, you know, as a result of colonial economic change and new infrastructural developments, things like trains and roads and those sorts of things. So mobility is greater in the colonial period, and this too affects Catholics, and this too contributes to what I would say is an increasingly powerful kind of awareness of a national religious identity. Now, it's not like in any other context, something that, you know, sort of mechanically displaces other older pre-existing identities. You know, we see this a lot after the partition, where you have a mass migration of Catholics from north to south, and some, you know, real tensions within the community surrounding, you know, sort of, I would say, regional religious cultures, right? But in a very important sense, this is what I would describe as the kind of the birth of a national religious consciousness through these kinds of changes, like pilgrimage, associations, migration, print, and the like.
Well, that then brings us into the next chapter, because you've shown how you now have a national church in chapter 5. In chapter 6, the culture and politics of Vietnamese Catholic nationalism, we now talk about how this national church is becoming more nationalistic.
Right. So this is...
But that means...
Oh, no, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, so how is though is this relationship between these two categories complex? But please go ahead and finish your thought.
That's what I was going to speak to. And it is really complicated, right? So on the one hand, on the Catholic side of things, you have this idea of being a Vietnamese Catholic, right, is more powerful. Accompanying with this is the idea that a burgeoning desire for not only religious independence, but I would say also national independence, political independence, right? Sort of a growing sense that colonialism is, should end, right? So there are similar things going on in Vietnamese society more broadly at this time. And what's complex about it is that, you know, many, if not most, other Vietnamese share this idea, this desire for national independence, right? But what's interesting is that precisely the same kinds of processes that are giving rise to a kind of a cultural Catholic nationalism. You know, this is one of the basic arguments about nationalism and modernity, right? Things like print and mobility and, you know, again, Benedict Anderson is a big influence on me. You know, where does national consciousness come from? It's not some sort of atavistic kind of pre-existing thing. It's the result of modernity, right? So the same kind of things are going on in Vietnam more broadly, but that process in Vietnamese society is giving rise to an idea of what Vietnamese-ness is. What does it mean to be Vietnamese, culturally speaking? And many important dimensions of this exclude Catholicism, right? Because they're seeking for the origins or the kind of true nature of what it means to be Vietnamese. And very often, you know, without being explicitly anti-Catholic, you know, they're associating Vietnamese-ness with things like, you know, Asian traditions like Confucianism and Buddhism, ancestral worship. You know, so there are things that they're increasingly kind of clear lines culturally being drawn that didn't necessarily exist beforehand in the same kind of way, right? So it's a kind of an irony that as Vietnamese Catholics are becoming more sort of national and nationalistic, there are also kind of lines being drawn between them and other Vietnamese that didn't necessarily exist in the same kind of way before, if that makes sense.
No, that makes perfect sense. And that it becomes such a tricky issue. I know that this happens all the time in issues of Korean national identity, especially in the late 19th, early 20th century. Mm-hmm. So you have then that Catholics are trying to insert themselves into this national story, make sure that they are considered a part of it. At the same time, they're under global influences like Catholic Action. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what this is and what role it played in Vietnam.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the second half of the chapter starts to try to make sense of some of the political ideas and choices that Catholics made during and after the Vietnamese Revolution. So Catholic Action was basically a sort of a papal movement to increase the participation of the laity, Catholic laity globally in the church. Right. It was in many ways a kind of a reaction to the rise of mass politics, especially in Europe. And these kind of mass political movements, obviously most worrisome were those on the left, and their structures. Right. So it was a kind of response to that in a sense, you know, get the laity much more actively involved and get them to be involved in things that, you know, in the same kinds of things that were drawing so many people toward mass politics in Europe, right? So really a much more closer awareness and involvement in social issues, right? Questions of, you know, especially of kind of poverty, the kind of disruptive effects and consequences of industrial life, right? All these kinds of things were things that Catholic Action tried to address and to get the Catholic laity to be much more involved in. So this, like, you know, many other things in European Catholic life, spread to Vietnam at the time. So it was definitely a major engine for mobilization. I actually discussed these Catholic Action in the previous chapter as one of these many forces creating a sort of a national consciousness and national networks within Vietnam among Catholics. In this chapter, I discuss its political dimensions more explicitly. And basically, and this gets to, you know, another question, two kind of new and important political idioms in Vietnamese Catholic life in the late colonial period, really in the 1930s. One being a kind of a, you know, left leaning social Catholicism, right? Which was, you know, I would say anti-communist, but, you know, not anti-leftist at all, some really clear sympathies with kind of mainstream European socialism, and certainly concerned with the same kind of issues, you know, questions of poverty, of social inequality, of, you know, again, the kind of disruptive effects of industrial life. I mean, this is something that's going on in Europe as well. Obviously, the left and the Catholic Church are not incompatible at all, right? So in a colonial context, what's interesting to me is that this gives rise to, you know, an important kind of political idea in Vietnamese Catholic life that is, you know, not at all opposed to, and in some cases quite supportive of, left-leaning anti-colonial movements in the late colonial period, right? So, you know, to answer the question, you know, how and why and in what ways could Vietnamese Catholics find themselves participating in a, you know, sort of communist-led revolution in and after 1945, I think this is a really important answer to that question. And that in the 1930s, really during the Great Depression, there arises in Vietnam a kind of a Catholic language of the left, if you will, right? And this, I think, really shapes a lot of Catholics' response to an understanding of the Vietnamese Revolution, at least initially, right? So that's one side. And then the other side is anti-communism. And I mentioned this at the beginning of the interview that, you know, ultimately many, if not most Catholics become quite opposed to a communist revolution in Vietnam. And here too, you know, the origins of this are not only in the revolutionary period, they're in the colonial period. And they stem from a lot of the things that we've been talking about. Most specifically, a kind of a global Catholic consciousness. And there is a global Catholic anti-communism that emerges in the interwar period, along with communism, right? And Vietnamese Catholics, like Catholics anywhere else, are aware of growing tensions between communist movements and the church. They're aware of, you know, the sort of the highly critical view that many communist movements have of organized religion in general and Catholicism in particular. And, you know, they're very aware of this, and they're aware of the rising influence of communism in anti-colonial politics in Vietnam. So, and this is, you know, so simultaneously with a kind of a sympathy for some leftist ideas and orientations, you know, some Vietnamese Catholics are becoming increasingly nervous about and opposed to communism in a way that, you know, also informs their political thinking and behavior after the revolution in 1945. So, you know, it's not contradictory, right? They're happening at the same time. The rise of a kind of leftist political orientation and the rise of anti-communism are simultaneous, really, in Vietnamese Catholic life.
So excellent. So, and in there, you're kind of talking in chapter six about this kind of this general kind of concern about the poverty in Vietnam. It's attracting communism, but also attracting things like Catholic Action. Mm-hmm. In chapter seven, you then you take the story forward a little bit more. You focus more a little bit more on the politics. Could you tell us a little about what's happening between 1940 and 1954, and how Catholics are reacting to it?
Absolutely. During World War II, the Japanese occupy French Indochina, and they essentially push the French out of power. You know, for all Vietnamese, this is a major moment. It's the displacement of colonial rule. It's a clear sign that, you know, colonial rule is potentially about to end. It's an important kind of nationalist moment. It's also a moment of, you know, severe hardship, like for most parts of Japanese occupied Asia. That has a kind of radical effect on culture and politics. You know, the big event obviously here is the Vietnamese Revolution in 1945, which essentially happens in the political vacuum left by the Japanese when they withdraw from Indochina in that summer. And the Vietnamese Revolution is an enormously complicated subject. Without being able to do real justice to its complexity, I would put it this way. The Vietnamese communist movement that eventually comes to control the Vietnamese Revolution during the War of Decolonization with France, which goes until 1954. In 1945, they are, you know, one among many political forces, you know, vying for influence in and control over an independent Vietnamese state. During the period from 45 to 54, Vietnamese communism gradually consolidates its influence and control over that revolutionary movement. And, you know, in doing so, you know, largely because of the revolution in China, it also becomes more radical, at least explicitly and visibly, you know, in its kind of ideas towards governance. So basically over this 9-year period from 1945 to 1954, you have a communist movement that is increasingly kind of powerful and controlling of revolutionary politics and increasingly radical in its approach to other political movements and political ideas. So the history of the Catholic Church in Vietnam during the revolution is in large part a kind of a function of that. Initially, virtually all Catholics in 1945 are ecstatic at the fact of independence. You know, some very prominent Catholics participate in the revolutionary government. There is, you know, mass support for independence from France and for the revolutionary government in 1945. So, you know, if anybody needed evidence or proof that Vietnamese Catholics were not, you know, pro-colonial, this is it. You know, the kind of mass outpouring of enthusiasm in 1945 for independence. You know, over the next 9 years, the relationship between the Vietnamese Catholic Church and the communist Vietnamese Communist Party becomes much more complicated. And this, you know, it's a complicated story. It's in large part due to the growing hostility of Vietnamese communists toward Catholics, like toward many other religious movements or political movements, for that matter. It also has to do with you know, with the Cold War and the kind of revitalization of anti-communism at the Vatican in the late 1940s. But, you know, mostly it's a function of the Vietnamese Revolution on the ground. So as the French become involved and really sort of lead a war to try to you know, basically in opposition to the Vietnamese Communist Revolution, Catholics become, you know, once again kind of aligned with that effort. Now here too, like with the conquest, the idea is not to support a reconquest of Vietnam. And really by 1949 or so, the French are really fighting to put in an anti-communist Vietnamese government in place. You know, the idea of taking the colony back is not really on the table anymore. So Catholics, over the course of that war become, you know, pretty clearly aligned with, anti-communist political forces in Vietnam. And these are the political forces that ultimately become, come to power in the southern part of Vietnam after the partition of the country in 1954 by diplomatic agreement. So by the end, I guess to sort of sum up, by the end of that war of decolonization, Catholics have become, you know, pretty clearly anti-communist, you know, for a number of reasons.
And then in the South, you have the rise to power of a Catholic. How do Catholics react to that?
You know, well, most of them are, you know, really quite quite happy, of course, to see a Catholic come to power in, you know, in Vietnam. So, yeah, so in 1954, you know, there's this the partition of the country. You know, it's largely a kind of a great power decision. You know, the U.S. put pressure to divide the country, puts pressure to divide Vietnam in two and to put some anti-communist political forces in power in the South. So that's what happens. The rise of Ngo Dinh Diem is also a really fascinating story. Here I could give a plug to my good friend Ed Miller's book, Misalliance, which came out, which is about Ngo Dinh Diem and his regime, which came out, you know, half a year after mine did with Harvard University Press. It's a really terrific book. But yeah, you know, so Ngo Dinh Diem, he's Catholic, but he's lots of other things too. He has a kind of a very complicated political vision for the country. He's strongly anti-communist, so you know most Catholics are very, very supportive of the Diem regime. Not all of them, though. His regime becomes increasingly kind of authoritarian and repressive in the late 50s and early 60s. You know, some Catholics grow kind of opposed to that. Again, I think, you know, the link between that and some of the sort of 1930s leftist and left-leaning Catholicism exists there. So, you know, Catholics, like anybody else, you know, they live under the Diem regime. And, you know, while they certainly do benefit from some, say, pro-Catholic policies, it's not a Catholic regime, right? You know, inevitably, you know, some of the kinds of things that make other South Vietnamese opposed to the Diem regime, Catholics start to have, you know, this sort of similarly complex relationship to the regimes in power in the South. The other important one, led by a guy named Nguyen Van Thieu, he was also Catholic. That's sort of another story in a sense. It, you know, the story of Catholicism in South Vietnam, well, or in North Vietnam for that matter, during the war is really a story that still has to be written. Where the book ends really is at that point in 1954. And what it tries to do is to suggest that some of the complexities and the sort of internal diversity and internal tensions of the Catholic community that I try to make clear in my book, I think are essential to understanding post-colonial Catholic history in Vietnam. Right, so you can have Catholics who were, you know, for their own reasons, legitimately committed to the communist revolution. You know, you had others who, you know, obviously were not, but were quite opposed for their own reasons to anti-communist regimes in the South. The point is that it's an incredibly complex story that's kind of really poorly understood still. So, you know, my hope is that at some point somebody can, you know, pick up where I left off once sources become more available in Vietnam. It's a little harder to research post-54 history in Vietnam, but it's becoming a little more manageable. So some people have started to do this. There is a guy named Peter Hansen who wrote a great thesis on the migration of Catholics from North to South in 54. Other scholars working on the period of the Vietnam War between 1954 and 1975, roughly. So, you know, I think that in the next, probably the next 10 years or so, there's going to be a much better literature on this than currently exists.
Oh, excellent. Well, we've you've given us a fascinating tour of your book. There's a lot of, for our listeners, there's a lot of details that, of course, we can't go into in an interview. So I hope you will pick up and read this book. But we've taken a lot of your time, but I'd like to take a little bit more of your time just to ask our traditional question. Mm-hmm. What are you working on now?
Well, I don't know if I mentioned this earlier, but I moved away from the history of Catholicism in Vietnam. I do feel like I sort of said what I have to say about it. This project, you know, again, as I said, it sort of started out. My interest my formation is really in Vietnamese history, right? Not in the history of Catholicism. So my interest remains kind of modern Vietnamese history. So I've kind of shifted to another, I think, important and, you know, poorly understood dimension of that, which is the relationship between metropolitan France and Vietnamese society. So specifically the experiences of Vietnamese in France during the colonial period. There were all these networks that kind of pulled Vietnamese into France and usually back again during the colonial era, whether they were political networks or educational networks, cultural kind of literary networks, labor networks. So there's this huge kind of movement of Vietnamese to France and then back, the world wars, and obviously soldiers who went to France to fight. So, you know, the basic question that I have is, what was the importance of actual experiences in metropolitan France for Vietnamese society and culture at this time? You know, and how did this shape a kind of Vietnamese modernity, for lack of a better word? So what I'm working on is this kind of process of mostly circular migration from Vietnam to France and back, and the experiences of Vietnamese in France and, you know, why that mattered. So there is a Catholic dimension to this. It's a small one, but it'll be in there. So I'm not leaving entirely, my interest in the work that I've done on this behind. But I'm definitely shifting gears quite significantly.
That sounds like a fascinating study, and I'm looking forward to it coming out.
Well, me too. Won't be for a while, but it's been fun to work on. I'm kind of in the thick of it now, and I'm enjoying it.
Oh, excellent. Well, thank you again so much for your time.
My pleasure.
And thank you to our listeners for hearing in.
My pleasure. I really appreciate you having me on and, you know, giving my book all this attention. It's really gratifying.
Well, it certainly deserves the attention.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Christian Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm Dr. Franklin Rausch of Lander University, the host of the channel. I want to thank you for listening to this interview, and I hope you'll come back and listen to another one again soon.